Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
As if the newspaper business isn't tough enough, a new browser is replacing all their ads. The fight over ad blocker is getting a whole lot uglier. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood, sitting in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday, April 8th. Thanks for taking the time with us today. And let's dive right into our weekly wrap-up of the economic news making waves this week. Our wrappers today are David Gura of Bloomberg and Neela Richardson of Redfin. Hello, you two.
Hey, Molly.
Hi, Molly.
Hi there. So, all right, let's jump right into tax inversions, kind of the big economic news of the week. The Treasury Department issuing new rules that just destroyed, as you know, the Pfizer-Allergan deal. But what are, Neela, let's start with you, what are, if any, some unintended consequences of these tax inversion rules?
You know what? The big picture, I think, is that the U.S. has a very high tax rate relative to the rest of the developed world. It's 35%. And U.S. companies are taxed on all of their income, both domestic and abroad. And that is also very different from the rest of the world. So the basics are that companies will try to do anything they can to privately fix the tax code, which means they will try to invert, which is to swallow up another foreign company so they can be based in a foreign land and avoid taxes. They'll do offshore accounts. They'll do all kinds of tricky mechanisms. So when you ask about unintended consequences, it's really the unintended consequence of having a very high tax rate relative to the rest of the world. It causes companies to kind of shift their money around to avoid it.
So, David, what are they going to do now? What are the new methods that they will find?
You know, I think this highlights again the need, many people would say, to tackle tax reform in Congress. It's been talked about for a while. Paul Ryan came in as Speaker. That sort of came up to the forefront again that, you know, maybe this was going to be the time that Congress was actually going to do that. But I think as the year goes on, as we get closer to the election, it seems like that's not happening. And Jack Lew, the Treasury Secretary, President Obama, both of them said, you know, as sharp the teeth were on these new rules, there's a limit to what the administration can do on its own. And to really curb inversions, they'd need Congress's help. And it doesn't seem like they're getting that anytime soon.
All right. Well, then let's move on to the Panama Papers, another area where overhaul may be needed. David Cameron admitting today he profited from an offshore trust. What happens now, David? I mean, sudden new Treasury rules about shell companies?
You know, I think you heard President Obama address this at the press conference. He gave a statement on the inversion rule, and the Panama Papers came up, and he used it to make the broader point here about the need to look at tax reform in the context of his belief that there are plenty of Americans who see what's happening here, see wealthy people in positions of power who are stashing their money in these shell companies overseas, feeling like they don't understand it. They don't know why that happens. They don't know why some people seem to get privileged status. So I think, you know, we'll see the administration use this again to push for more tax reform. But as Neela was saying, you know, 11.5 million documents, more than 2 terabytes of documents from this Panamanian law firm. An amazing amount of secrecy went into the early stage of this as this consortium of journalists went through it. You know, we saw the headlines. We saw the dramatic video of the Prime Minister of Iceland being presented with these facts and then having to leave his position just a couple hours or a few hours later. You know, I think that from what I hear, people are going to begin digging through this, looking for relationships now to major banks. And you're seeing a lot of major banks already doing their own internal investigations just to see sort of what relationships they may or may not have had with this Panamanian firm.
So let's very quickly touch on Yahoo. David, that sale book was a disaster. Why is there even talk of companies still bidding?
Yeah, I mean, I from what I hear, a company like Verizon may be interested in some of the advertising component of what Yahoo has to offer. We had just a couple of weeks ago Starboard Value suggesting that the whole board at Yahoo needed to be overhauled. Everybody needed to be out. They wanted to put new people in. It seemed like sentiment was starting to turn here. I was on set yesterday when this news broke. Our deals reporter came on to talk about it. You know, the big surprise to me, I think, is Google's interest here. We'd heard about Verizon potentially being interested in the company. The fact that Google is now really fascinating to me, and I'm eager to see what happens here. I gather that the first round of bids here will be due next week.
Yeah, Neela, some people had actually suggested that Google, this might have been the plan all along, put Marissa in as a Trojan horse and then get Google to buy it.
Wow, that's a conspiracy theory. Look, there is something that Yahoo has to offer, which may be the underlying reason behind a potential bidding war next week. They have eyeballs. This site gets more views than almost any other internet site in the country. It's the third largest. Millions of people go to yahoo.com, and there is a potential there that is untapped. It's a clean source of untapped profits. The fact that Yahoo and its leadership has never been able to convert those eyeballs into dollars just makes it even more attractive to all these firms who think that they can do a better job at it.
They think, and we'll see. That's Neela Richardson from Redfin and David Gura from Bloomberg. Happy weekend, guys.
You too.
Thank you.
On Wall Street today, stocks tried for a recovery and mostly fell flat. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The Export-Import Bank has had a tough couple of years. It's the government agency that U.S. exporters can use when their foreign customers need loans to buy their goods. Not everyone thinks it's necessary. Last year, there was a long battle about whether to shut it down. The bank was eventually reauthorized, but three of the five seats on its board are empty. So while the Exim Bank limps along, companies like Boeing say they're taking the hit. Marketplace's Sabri Menashor reports.
Charles Stakistad runs an aerospace firm called Kinetics. They do satellites, communication, that sort of thing. And when he sells abroad, he has an issue.
If you happen to have, like we do, revenue coming from outside of the country, most of the banks here in the States will not let you borrow against that.
So if your customer needs a loan to buy your stuff, you can't help them out. They don't buy, you don't sell. So the government steps in as the Exim Bank to help finance things. The issue right now is that there are vacancies on the bank's board. The Senate refuses to hold confirmation hearings. Because of that,
they can't approve projects, transactions over $10 million.
That's Linda Dempsey with the National Association of Manufacturers. Small businesses can get their projects through, big ones can't.
We've heard from a number of different industry sectors in transportation and capital equipment and energy. There is $10 to $12 billion in the pipeline awaiting approval that can't move forward.
Boeing says its customers like Ethiopian Air have already told them they're going to go somewhere else without the bank.
I don't think we should be concerned about it.
Veronique Derougy is with the market-oriented Mercatus Center. She says helping foreign customers get financing gives those foreign customers an unfair advantage.
So Air Emirates gets a cheap loan, buys a Boeing plane, and then ends up competing with Delta.
But at the same time, most other countries have Exim banks, and they use them to promote their own export industries. Chel Stakistad, the satellite guy, says he's seen the French Export Bank, for example, help French companies snatch clients from U.S. companies.
The French have an agenda that they want to really significantly increase their market share for low-Earth orbiting satellites.
Senator Richard Shelby this week said he was in no hurry to fill the bank's vacancies. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Let's check in on the ad-blocking debate. U.S. newspapers are having a collective freakout about a new ad-blocking browser by a company called Brave Software. The browser will replace many of the ads that appear on a publisher's website with ads picked by Brave itself. A group of the biggest newspaper publishers, including the Washington Post and the New York Times, sent a cease and desist letter to Brave. They said its software is, quote, illegal, and that even though Brave plans to share revenue with publishers, it ain't nearly enough. But Brave is only the latest, if the flashiest, example of ad blocking tech that is getting a lot more popular. And since most of the web runs on ads, Marketplace's Annie Baxter asked the question, what's next?
When you visit a website, an auction occurs, determining what ad to place in front of you based on your online activity. Consumers don't like getting tracked like this or having ads slow down web pages. That's how Brave is different, according to Chief Executive Brendan Eich.
Brave software is building a better browser that is much faster and safer and more private than any other browser by blocking all the third-party ads and trackers that are slowing down the internet.
Brave will still present ads, and they will still be targeted at you in some fashion. But Ike says it won't let third-party trackers follow you from site to site. Ike says Brave will give a 55% cut of the ad revenue to the publisher's website and a Bitcoin micropayment to the user. But publishers say Brave is just replacing their ads with ones that, quote, Brave sells for its own profit, unquote. Media expert Aram Sinreich at American University agrees that Brave's plan is not altogether altruistic.
This is a very smart technology that plays on consumer fears of corporate surveillance in order to inject itself as a kind of middleman between advertisers, publishers, and consumers.
Journalism professor Dan Kennedy at Northeastern University says publishers are partly responsible for this mess, having gummed up their sites with clunky ads that people now want to block.
The rise of ad blocking in general, and what Brave is doing in particular, will only hasten the move to native advertising, sponsored content.
In other words, ads that can sometimes be hard to separate from actual journalism. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Let's talk immigration. It's a hot topic in the presidential election. Latinos make up a growing proportion of those who will be voting in primaries and in November, and candidates on both sides have proposals for how to fix the system. They're, of course, trying to balance security concerns with the realities of America today. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams, usually reporting for us in D.C., has been out along the U.S.-Mexico border looking at how this debate is playing out on both sides. Hi, Kimberly. How are you?
Hi, Molly. I'm fine.
So, Kimberly, where are you right now?
So right now, I'm just a couple of feet from the border fence in Tijuana, Mexico. And it's actually a really interesting place to look at the dichotomy of the immigration debate in the U.S., but from this side of the border. Just behind me on this sort of corrugated steel wall, there's graffiti that says on a door that is obviously very well sealed, USA now hiring, but underneath it, keep out. This idea that even though people want to move to the U.S. for jobs, it's not exactly the most welcoming. And then just a few feet down is this big mural, I'm walking over to it now, of Donald Trump with some things I probably shouldn't say on the radio with it.
And you were in San Diego yesterday, right? Just across the border from where you are now. What is the debate like there?
Yeah, I was over there attending this event for the Cross Border Bridge, which is a land bridge between San Diego and the Tijuana airport. Officials and business people in San Diego and Tijuana are trying to promote economic ties between the two communities that are so closely linked by the border. And there was a lot of indirect shade thrown at Donald Trump in some of the comments that he's made in this presidential campaign about immigration in the speeches, particularly by Mexican officials. And then after the event was over, I spoke to Gil Kerlikowske, who is the commissioner of U.S. Customs and Border Protection, and I asked him about presidential candidate Donald Trump's plan to build a border wall, or at least say that he's going to build a border wall. Kerlikowske said he tries to stay out of politics, but he then added this.
We have hundreds of miles now of border fencing. It's very difficult to maintain. It's very expensive. And we also can tell you that given the terrain that this border from San Diego through the Rio Grande Valley and the river, the deserts and the mountains, that a wall would be impossible to build.
Of course, Donald Trump says it is possible to build that wall and that he'd make Mexico pay for it at a cost of about $8 billion, a number which many experts say is far too low.
Well, geographically impossible seems tough to overcome, too, but I guess we'll see.
It does, doesn't it?
What other economic issues around immigration have come up so far in your reporting?
So one interesting thing is the way that undocumented people already in the U.S. are influencing the campaign. You know, even super politically active groups like the Dreamers and people even who have work visas to be in the U.S. legally but aren't citizens, they can't vote and they also can't donate to presidential campaigns because they're not U.S. citizens. So you have a lot of people in the United States who are undocumented that want to play a role in this process but can't give money. So you have a lot of interesting work arounds with people volunteering time, canvassing phone banks, and even some people even working for the presidential campaigns.
Wow, that's Marketplace's Kimberly Adams in Tijuana. Thanks, Kimberly.
Thank you, Molly.
Kimberly's Border Reporting is produced with support from the International Women's Media Foundation. Coming up?
We wrote a feature with a lot of the same stuff that's still in the movie now, but 7-8 years ago, could not really get anybody to look at it.
How Melissa McCarthy got the doors to open up. But first, let's do the numbers. Pass the happy music, but just barely. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 35 points, 0.2% to close at 17,576. The NASDAQ rose 2 points, remaining essentially unchanged to land at 4850. And the S&P 500 added 5 points, 0.2% to end at 2047. For the week, the Dow lost 1.2%, the S&P declined 1.2%, and the NASDAQ lost 1.3%. We talked earlier about Boeing's woes with those open seats on the board of the Export-Import Bank. Boeing soared 0.2%. Lockheed Martin and Northrop Grumman both barely budged. Oil prices were up today on word that the U.S. tapped into its crude stockpiles. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.71%. And you are listening to Marketplace. You're listening to Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. Let's talk about power for a second here and a little bit about worst-case scenarios. Imagine that a terror attack or a cyber attack takes out a big piece of the power grid. One national study says you could be in the dark for 18 months. That's how long it takes to replace big critical transformers that are mostly made overseas. So 8 of the nation's largest utility companies are about to launch a new organization to stockpile the most important components of the electricity system. And I, for one, am delighted to hear it. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports.
By month's end, the company Grid Assurance plans to start up with funds from big utilities, including Duke, Southern, Berkshire Hathaway Energy. These firms have some spare transformers and other critical parts for, say, lightning strikes, but not enough for the big threats, terror, cyber, megastorms. Scott Moore is VP of American Electric Power.
Under a terrorist attack where they come and wipe out the whole substation, then you lose your sparing capability. And that's what Grid Assurance is trying to basically insure against.
It is basically insurance, so it makes sense to pool money and pool risk, says Peter Fox Penner of Boston University's Questrom School of Business.
It would make no economic sense for every utility to stockpile these very, very expensive transformers and other switchgear, but it also makes no sense to have no stockpile whatsoever.
Utilities would subscribe to the service and the money would buy the critical pieces. But spare parts aren't enough. A safe grid takes timely intelligence, modern equipment, and money. Masoud Amin is professor of electrical and computer engineering at the University of Minnesota.
H.M. Mencken said, for every complex problem, there is a single solution that's simple, neat, and wrong. So here, it's a complex problem, but we need to see the whole system.
This is long overdue, he says, and that 9/11 and a cyber attack on Ukraine's grid have scared people into action. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Melissa McCarthy has no shortage of movie roles these days. Here's a fun fact. In movies where she has played a lead role, those films have grossed more than $500 million domestically. That's according to Box Office Mojo. And yes, she is reportedly going to do the Gilmore Girls reboot. In theaters this weekend, though, she plays Michelle Darnell, a.k.a. The Boss, in the new comedy that she co-wrote and her husband, Ben Falcone, directed. The Boss is the second film from the husband-wife team, and after the success of 2014's Tammy, doesn't seem like it's going to be their last. Kai Ryssdal met up with McCarthy and Falcone to learn about the family business of being funny. They started out talking about the origins of Michelle Darnell.
Yeah, it's almost a little strange. I did her about 16 years ago at the Groundlings Theater, and just something about her. It was like I've had it with a couple characters, but I couldn't shake her.
You knew, you say, what she looked like, what she wore, how she acted, the whole deal.
Everything. It was like a 3D blast of her voice, how she stands, how she treats people, weird sayings she would have. I knew what her seminar was about.
Wow.
I mean, I wish everything came that
I know, I was going to say, it would be great if everything sort of came like
it
that.
It does not. It does not happen like that.
How come it took you 15 years to get it to the big screen then? I mean, you've been sitting around?
Well, that's a great question. About 7 or 8 years ago, Steve Mallory and I, that's who we
Buddy yours who you wrote the film with, yeah.
And he's in the movie.
Yeah.
We wrote a feature with a lot of the same stuff that's still in the movie now, but 7-8 years ago, could not really get anybody to look at it.
Yeah, they wrote this outline that was really funny. And then it wasn't until Tammy was successful that
right.
people said, hey, you guys could do another one. And we said,
Well, what about Michelle Darnell?
You two have known each other for a good long while now.
Yeah.
Tell me a story, Ben.
Well, we
chuckle from the other side of the room.
We met at Groundlings in level 3. There's levels there.
Yes.
We should say what Groundlings is. Groundlings is an improv sketch theater in Los Angeles, California.
And it's a school, basically.
Yeah, and it's a school.
Everybody who becomes a
Groundling has gone through the school. So I met Melissa in level 3. She was right next to me, and she was smart and cute and nice, and I felt comfortable. I would say, a couple years later, we were dating, and then then we got married. We got all married up after that. But yeah, that's where we met at the Groundlings in a tiny room.
How does it work when you two sit down to work? Do you have like a partner's desk and you work across from each other, and do you throw ideas up on a whiteboard? Or how does that whole process go?
We finally got an office, which we feel very, very grown up, because for a long time we wrote at the dining room table or in our car because it was the only time we could get some space.
Peace and quiet.
Yeah. So we literally wrote most of Tammy in a car or at the dining room table. Now we have an office. It's kind of catch as catch can. It's like sometimes we switch back and forth, and one will write while the other kind of like
thinks out loud,
and then we switch.
I pace.
Do you?
I pace a lot. And I just walk around.
I'm built to move.
and then once you get it done, what do you do as the director? Do you sit down and break it up and say, I got to do this, and then I got to do that?
Yes. Yeah. So like once we have a script that we're happy with, what happens is we know we're going to do another rewrite. But in the meantime, we're starting to think about, well, who are we casting?
Right.
So, yeah, I start to do the business of directing. It would be interesting someday to direct something that we didn't write, because we spend so much time writing it and it's all so fluid.
And we never stop writing. We never stop rewriting. I mean, I'm the worst. Ben makes fun of me because all through editing, all through post, anytime I turn my head, I want to put a line in. I keep adding
so
lines
like
through the.
Then,
I'm
right?
a nightmare. I don't know how he puts up with
me. No, it's great because she's always wanting to make it better.
So here's a trickier question then. Let's say you disagree and you're the talent, but your husband's the boss. Who decides?
Well, I think with most things, I mean, if I feel really comfortable with the director, if somebody else has an idea, I think I've tanked so many times on stage and in so many different arenas that I don't have any ego with that kind of stuff. Huh. And if I think something is so incredible, like this is the one, it's so often not the one. That as long as I get to do my idea and be like, let me show you this one, and then what are you thinking? And then we'll duke it out.
Both. And we actually got a really great note from Susan Sarandon when we worked one of our first days on Tammy, because what we were doing is like what everybody does. We were new and like we're like, oh, we got a take. And we're like, well, let's talk about it. And like, well, should we have one where she tries this? Or well, what do you think? I don't know. Maybe this. And Susan just goes, guys, it'd be a lot faster if we just did it that way. If you're thinking about it, why don't we just shoot it? And then you just have it.
The time it takes to discuss. Should we do one that's angrier? And we were kind of intellectualizing about it and talking about the pros and cons. And she said, we could have had two shot by now. And we really follow that rule now.
Different but related topic, I guess.
Yes.
Has this whole fame thing turned out to be what you thought it would be? Because, I mean, you went from studying textiles in college to doing improv and a bunch of stuff. And now here you are. You're like an A-list person.
I don't know. We don't think about it.
No, come on.
I mean, it's not – I think kids are the great equalizer. Like you can't get too impressed with yourself when really you're just a vehicle to reach things on high shelves for two creatures.
Tell me about it.
And also I think we spent so many years – I mean, I spent 20 years just trying to get a job desperately. And every day that I actually get to work, I truly and honestly just think I can't believe – I'm here. I get to do this. It's like I just think about the next character or like, oh, I have a weird idea for a story. Like that to me is what is really exciting. And if having your things go well means you get to do another one, then I'm in. I mean, that's
the
joy.
The definition of like the thing, which is, okay, if this goes well, you can do it again.
You can do it again, right?
Yeah.
It's a film called The Boss. Melissa McCarthy stars. Ben Falcone directed. They co-wrote, co-produced, did the whole smash. Thanks a lot, you guys.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us. This final note before we go, if you were convinced that by drinking vitamin water, a Coca-Cola product, you were improving your eyesight, feeling more physically and mentally healthy, noticing that your joints were oh so much more nimble, I just did a little chicken dance there, it might have all been in your mind. A court has approved a settlement agreement between Coca-Cola and the Center for Science and the Public Interest in a class action lawsuit over the drink and the claims on its label. Under the agreement, Coca-Cola will stop advertising health benefits from drinking vitamin water, but it will make it clear that each drink contains about 32 grams of sugar. And that's the show for today and the week. Today, the Dow gained 35 points, 0.2%. The NASDAQ rose 2 points, remaining essentially unchanged. The S&P 500 added 5 points, a paltry 0.2%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitara Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Molly Wood. Have a great weekend. We'll be back on Monday. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.